Good morning. I'm Pam McElvain, your host of The Inclusive Voice, here with you on this wonderful Saturday morning. Here I'm bringing right now diversity news on April 30th, Congress, the Senate's Intellectual Property Subcommittee, hearing on the No Fakes Act to protect people from unauthorized digital replicas on Tuesday, featured Talaha Bartnett, known professionally as FKA Twigs, a British singer, songwriter, and dancer. The hearing titled Protecting Americans from Unauthorized Digital Replicas heard from several witnesses about potential impacts that digital duplicates could have online. Bartnett has spent the past year creating a deepfake replica of herself that she will use to engage with her fans online while she spends more time making art. Not necessarily a bad thing. However, she isn't opposed to using the use of AI or deepfakes in this capacity. But she is asking for technology to be regulated, as she has heard multiple songs over the years using her voice that she did not make. So while the use of AI deepfakes can be a valuable tool for artists and creatives, it can also present dangers when it comes to their personal branding and protection of their creative assets. In fact, it can become a danger to you or anyone that is looking to do anything outside of the box, if you will. So AI use, while it's great to have access to, you have to be very careful and conscious in how others have the ability to mimic what's going on. And then right around the corner, I just want to mention Mother's Day. It's a great time to shine the light on the 24.2 million working mothers in the U.S., even more abroad, can you imagine? A record number of American women are reaching the executive suite. And a significant portion of women are now running major U.S. corporations, and they have children. So yet, despite the tremendous progress, working mothers still face numerous challenges at work and home. Struggles that COVID-19 pandemic aggravated. Everyone doesn't get to work at home and enjoy the successes of career advancement. So here today to speak with us, we have Wall Street Journal contributor and author of Power Moms, How Executive Mothers Navigate Their Work and Life, Joanne Lublin. So stay tuned right after this commercial break. We'll be right back with you.
Breakthroughs aren't just for medical journals. They're to help people hold their grandbabies for the first time. Expertise isn't just for awards or recognition. It can be what gives people the best chance to walk again. At the Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Health Network, people are the driving force behind everything we do. So we never lose sight of what's important. And we never forget who it's for. Because in the end, we're people helping people. That means every breakthrough, every clinical study, every interaction is to help people like you, your family, and your neighbors be the best they can be. We do everything possible because we see everything possible in you. To find out how compassion motivates world-class care, visit Froedtert.com.
The world is embracing a remote, globalized, and diverse workforce. Is your organization prepared when it comes to understanding all the nuances of diversity? Diversity MBA can help. From an industry-leading journal and web publication highlighting professionals and best practices, to boot camps and conferences featuring noted and accomplished speakers, Diversity MBA is a driving force in diversity, equity, and inclusion education. Check out DiversityMBAMagazine.com and take the first step towards transforming your organization.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Inclusive Voice. I'm your host, Pam McElvain. Thank you for joining us on this glorious Chicago morning. We have with us, as I mentioned earlier, Joanne Lublin. Oh, my goodness, I'm so excited to have her with us. Not only is she this phenomenal award-winning journalist, but she's this great author who wrote this incredible book on executive mothers and moms. And we're going to talk about what that means to be this high-powered woman today at home and in the workplace. So before we get started, Joanne, I want to say thank you and welcome to our show this morning. And what do you do to keep yourself both mentally and physically well?
Well, I'll tell you how I keep myself both mentally and physically well, Pam. I look at life as the glass half full, not the glass half empty. And so whatever goes wrong or whatever goes right, it's part of keeping that glass half full. And so I have a pretty positive mental attitude, and that indeed keeps me going mentally and physically.
You know what? I really love that approach because optimism always. I'm going to have to join you in taking that view as well. So I really want to thank you, and I'm humbled to have you on our show to really talk about not just your new book, but to bring in your wealth of experience and the work that you've been doing around following, you know, executive women. So the first thing I like to do, though, is spend a little time talking a bit about your background. I think it's important for folks to kind of know who you are. So, you know, where did you go to school? Where did you grow up? And what really, you know, inspired you to go into journalism?
Well, what really inspired me to go into journalism was the fact that I wrote a poem, if you can believe, in first or second grade, and it was published in the PTA newsletter. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. So in fourth grade, I and a bunch of other elementary school students decided to launch a school newspaper. We had a contest to name it, and my title won. The name of the school was Walt Whitman Elementary School. This was out on Long Island. So it was the Walt Whitman News and Views. And I kind of got the writing bug, the journalism bug. If you look at one of my early childhood diaries, you find out that my fantasy was to become a famous novelist one day.
And I was
going to have a pseudonym that was modeled after Mark Twain, who was one of my favorite authors. Yes. And what the diary says is my pseudonym was going to be Marcy Wayne. Mark Twain. I continued working on the school paper in junior high, high school, then decided to major in journalism, and that's when I discovered my love for Chicago. I lived in Evanston for 4 years and worked on the Daily Northwestern. I was one of the top editors on the Daily Northwestern. When I finished my undergraduate degree, there were no jobs. I have sort of seen through my life that at the beginning of every decade, there seems to be a recession. So I decided to get another degree in journalism, and I went out to California and got a master's in Stanford. A master's thesis was not required, but I had a topic I thought was very compelling and asked if I could do a thesis. They said, sure. So I did my master's thesis on the question, is there discrimination against newspaper women? And I wrote a thesis that ended up getting pretty widely read, and actually subsequent graduate students tried to repeat some of my breakthrough research on the fact that the women who went into newspaper work who experienced the least amount of gender bias were ones who had male bosses who had ever worked for a woman. Now, that was pretty rare at that point, but there were a number of small town papers where the publisher died at a young age, and the widow took over the newspaper, and the city editor then learned what it was like to work for a woman. After finishing grad school, I was hired by the Wall Street Journal in San Francisco because I had already had a summer internship with the Wall Street Journal in the Washington Bureau between my junior and senior years. When I joined the Wall Street Journal in the early 1970s, there were only about a dozen women in the entire news department. The highest ranking woman was a copy editor. And under the journal's nepotism policies, when she and a male editor got engaged, they summoned the couple to the top editors and said, okay, under this woman was a highest ranking woman at the journal at the time that I was hired. She was a copy editor. Mm-hmm. But when she got engaged to another editor, the nepotism rule kicked in and they basically told her that she had to quit. And I spent my entire professional career at the Wall Street Journal, moving from San Francisco back to Chicago so my husband could go to grad school again at Northwestern. We had met working on the Daily Northwestern. We then moved to Washington, D.C. I moved into management and was offered a job in the London Bureau as the second in command there. It was the first bureau where it was run by two women, female bureau chief and female deputy bureau chief, myself. I returned then to the U.S. To cover management issues in the starting the 1990s, and eventually introduced the Wall Street Journal to covering career issues by creating its first career advice column. It's a column I continue to write for over 2 years after leaving full-time employment. And I am now a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, which basically means I'm a high-level freelancer for the journal.
That's incredible. What an most impactful story. And you know what's amazing is when you talk about, you know, as a child, you're inspired and you saw the, you know, the realities of actually, you know, being creative and seeing it in print and to actually pursue that. Not everyone, you know, is able to realize and, you know, manifest their childhood dreams. And so kudos to you for doing that and really becoming, and I just want to say this so that our listening audience knows this, is that Joanne Lublin is, you know, not only as you heard her story talk about this incredible journalist that's done some breakthrough work, but she also shared the Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for stories about corporate scandals. And we'll talk to her a little bit more about that. But also in her popular book in 2016, Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. And then the 2018 Lifetime Achievement Award from the prestigious, you know, one of the prestigious Bloop Awards. So it's incredible because it's the highest accolades in journalism that anyone has received. So I'm very, very humbled. We are, as our listening audience, to have you. And what I also will say is thank you for your work. And it's unfortunate that some of the breakthrough discoveries that you had about women in the workplace, we're reliving some of those again decades later. So really, really can't wait to talk to you a little bit more, Joanne, about what you, you know, what you think about today's environment. So we're gonna take just a couple moments and do a quick commercial break. Thank you, Joanne, for joining us and sharing your journey with you and how you actually grew up. So we're excited to learn a little bit more about the work you currently are doing and have done. So we'll be right back.
At UPMC, we believe care goes beyond our walls and into our communities. That's why we support organizations and individuals who help people prosper by giving them skills and training for employment, including right here at UPMC. Because life-changing is providing people a chance to grow. Learn more at upmc.com/community impact. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
From emails that get no response, to improper billing and shipping, to inventory mistakes, waste can be an expansive, encompassing problem. With a track record of success that includes over $7 billion in successful projects, Bold Business has been helping clients over two decades. Whether you seek to enhance the performance of current anti-waste and waste initiatives, reduce reputational damage in the face of heightened public scrutiny, or simply safeguard cost efficiency, Bold Business has the answers. Check out boldbusiness.com for more information.
Thank you all for stay tuned with us as I am interviewing Joanne Lublin. As you mentioned earlier, for those of you just now joining us, she's one of the trailblazers and phenomenons in journalism that has really created spaces for women at home and at work. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But prior to doing that, though, I did mention that she's a 2018 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Lube Awards, which is the highest accolade in business journalism. Just want to make sure that we correct that achievement. But nonetheless, you know, it's a significant one. So Joanne, just to chat with you about, I know we really weren't going to talk about your other book, Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. And I know at the time, you know, you were writing it, there's a lot of stuff going on in the business community. But are there some of the things that you could think about, some of those lessons that are relevant for today that you don't mind sharing?
Sure. And let me just tell you a little bit about how that first book came about.
Oh, excellent.
I got the idea for the book after writing a first-person essay for a Wall Street Journal blog that doesn't exist anymore, but it was called Journal Women. And it was an essay directed at my daughter, who was then joining the workplace. And I wanted her to understand that although it would feel like things were relatively easy and cool for women when she was joining the workforce, it hadn't always been the case, and that each of us, even one day after we've started a job, literally owe it to pay it forward to the less senior female employee who's just been hired, who can benefit from our successes as well as our setbacks. And so I wrote this first person essay that basically describes some of the strange and, to me, mysterious experiences I had when I joined the workforce as a journalist in the early 1970s and was not taken very seriously as a woman, in order to make it clear to her that she needed to pay it forward. So out of that essay and out of the huge response I got from other women, I decided to do a book about women who had gotten to be into senior management ranks and perhaps had overcome barriers, particularly gender bias related barriers. I interviewed 52 senior executive women, but what I discovered was that many of them had to deal with challenges, both personal and professional, not just involving gender bias, but all kinds of setbacks. And what the overarching theme and lesson from Earning It was that learning how to deal with challenges, learning how to overcome obstacles, particularly ones that had to do with gender, actually made them more successful, stronger leaders. These were 52 women, all but one of whom were baby boomers, many of whom, when men were first assigned to them as staffers, as subordinates, refused to work for them because they had never worked for a woman before, or ran into situations where they couldn't get promoted because a woman had never been in that position, or got a promotion while they were in labor. The book Wow. got a tremendously strong reaction. It came out before the Me Too movement. And yet the opening chapter is all about how I personally experienced sexual harassment during my time as a summer intern in the Washington Bureau, and then completely repressed the memory until years later when a certain Supreme Court justice nominee was being grilled about his sexual harassment behavior. And suddenly this light bulb went on that, oh my gosh, I experienced this. the man who was my direct supervisor, when I was a summer intern on my last day on the job in the outer lobby, just the two of us, kissed me on the lips to say goodbye. Wow. And I was, you know, between my junior and senior year of college, I felt at the time I couldn't say anything about it. And then I completely repressed the memory until Clarence Thomas was nominated for the Supreme Court.
Oh my goodness. You know what? Thank you for sharing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it's, that is just so significant where, you know, you have to have a major landscape, you know, initiative or experience to occur for people to think about and for that to resonate with them. As you know, decades later, right, with the sexual harassment issues with Weinstein in Hollywood. So I really do understand. And your book, you were just so far ahead with that book, Joanne, because just as you listening to you speak, I'm like, oh my goodness, I experienced these things in corporate America. So here we are today being able to continue to experience, you know, deal with some of those initiatives. But I definitely am going to, just got your other book, so now I'm going to have to get this book, because I definitely want to read this book, because I do believe you're right. You know, when women are able to digest, and probably not just women, but people that can digest some of these experiences, you know, you have another level of strength there. But, you know, you're a mom yourself. And raising two children, yet, you know, power mom yourself in the work and the level of journalism that you're operating at. I mean, what made you, I mean, were you inspired to write the next book about power moms from your experiences and work with other women? But what made you want to sit down and put pen to paper in this book that we're getting ready to talk about, Power Moms, How Executive Mothers Navigate Work and Life?
Well, what was interesting, Pam, about many of those women that I interviewed for Earning It was that it turns out that a majority of them were also mothers. And then when you look more closely at those in that group who became public company chief executives, women like Mary Barra at General Motors, who's a prominent example, and many others, the proportion of women who become public company CEOs and also have children is higher than the overall sample. So what was it that enabled them to achieve essentially the top job in, you know, major companies and at the same time raise a family? So that was part of the genesis for doing another book. But I was also curious, since overwhelmingly the women featured in Earning It were the trailblazers, they were usually the first woman in senior management. There was one woman, in fact, who was the only woman on a team of executives reporting to the CEO, and she was already pretty tall and yet would wear 3-inch heels to make her 5'10" rather than 5'7". And I asked her, "You're already pretty tall, why do you have to wear the 3-inch heels?" And she said, "Because if I'm the only woman on the CEO's direct reports, the CEO's senior leadership team, I want to be able to stare every other guy in the eyes." Love. But it did make me wonder whether these trailblazing women from Earning It, the boomers, had indeed made things easier for the next wave, for the next generation of women who were moving into executive ranks and also having children. So that became the basis for Power Moms. I interviewed 86 women who at some point in their careers had worked for a company with at least $100 million in revenue, But I didn't care if they were now at a startup or had left corporate America to start their own company. And they were roughly divided between baby boomers and then the next wave, who were millennials and Gen Xers, who when I did these interviews, which was over 4 years ago, were anywhere from their early 30s to their early 40s. Because I wanted to know, had things gotten better? Had things gotten worse? Had they stayed the same in terms of women's advancement, and in particular, women's moving into higher levels of management when they had children? In addition to those 86 executive mothers, I interviewed 25 young adult daughters of the boomers, mostly women in their 20s. I wanted to know, what was it like growing up with a larger-than-life mother? I wanted to find out whether it was easy or hard to have a mom who was a power mom.
Just real quickly, what was the answer to that?
The answer was, at times it was difficult, and at times it was inspiring. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, particularly as these daughters moved through high school and college, they really appreciated the fact that they had a secret career weapon, and that secret career weapon was MOM.
That's
because
right.
Because their mothers knew all about networking. Their mothers understood how to pitch a job request or an interview request. Their mothers knew how to open doors, and in fact ended up becoming not only their career coaches for job hunting, but once these young women landed their first couple jobs, particularly when they started moving into supervisory roles, they often called on mom, sometimes dragging her out of a meeting, an important meeting, to say, what do? I have this dilemma facing me. It got to the point that these secret career weapons were so effective that some of the power mom's daughters said their friends would come to them and say, would your mom mind looking at my LinkedIn profile or critiquing my thank you note for the job interview I just had?
Yeah, so this sounds very familiar, and that's actually true. One of the things then we'll move on, but one of the things that I've learned in my experience with a lot of senior level women is that the husband, the role that he plays, and it's, it's this partnership where they recognize, the spouses recognize that I have a power wife. And, I'm willing to do, take a I don't want to say a secondary role, but to step back on certain other things and become primary in some of the child rearing. Did you find that to be one of the challenges or struggles with many of the women, particularly those of them, as the public company CEOs?
It definitely was a challenge, and I observed that in reporting both books, but especially for Power Moms. There was a great example of one of those Power Moms. She was among the half dozen or so women who made appearances in both books. Not only did her husband choose to be a stay-at-home dad, but they celebrated his role as the hands-on parent, to the point that on Mother's Day, the children honored both parents because we're seeing dad as their second mom.
Wow. I love that. I hadn't heard that. So that's really good to hear. And thank you for sharing. One of the questions I did want to ask is just a little bit about the diversity of the women that you interviewed. You definitely talked about their level executives, but were you able to have a diverse group of women between both the generations as you were doing your interviews?
So in Power Moms, about 19% of the 86 executive women are women of color, and that was a much higher percentage than in Earning It. Of course, that's a reflection of the not only gender bias, but racial bias that both persist today, yes, but were particularly predominant when these boomer women were moving into management. Yeah. What was interesting, though, about the women of color that I met for Power Moms was how they were able to succeed in their careers for a variety of reasons, but one very important factor was the fact that their own parents were extensively involved with helping to rear the children. And yes, there's a great example in Power Moms involving an IBM executive named Inhi Cho Su. Inhi was 5 years old when her parents left their native South Korea to come to the United States. Mm-hmm. Her first job at IBM is as a lowly marketing assistant. Yet by the time she's 32, she's a vice president, the youngest ever vice president in IBM history. She ends up marrying a guy who also becomes an IBM executive. They're living in North Carolina near a number of family members. When they are both offered an opportunity to move close to headquarters in suburban New York, the problem is they're going to be buying a home in Connecticut. They have no friends, no family. They both obviously have very high-powered jobs. So Inhi reaches out to her mom and dad, who at that point are both small business owners, to ask them if there's some way that they could help. Her mom's reply is that both she and Inhi's father have decided to sell their businesses, leave where they're living, and move in with Inhi and her husband and their two very young sons, and essentially become the second set of parents to help with child rearing. Inhi asks her, "Mom, this is overwhelmingly generous. Why would you do this?" And her mom said, "It's because your son is rising and my son is setting." And as Inhi tried to tell me this story, she choked up. She started crying. And that was true for almost a dozen women that I interviewed for Power Moms. I don't remember a single woman I interviewed for Earning It choking up, but there were so many very, very personal stories that these women all shared, all on the record, nothing hidden from view, warts and all, about their struggles to feel good about what they were doing at home and their struggles to be successful on the job.
And you know what, that, and let that be the reason, Joanne, I need to do everything in my power to make sure your book is out there, because I do believe today's generation, we need to be able to hear those stories and to go back and not just reflect on ours and those in our communities, but, you know, so how women actually overcame them and know that, you know, you can empathize, know that you're going to have feelings, know that it's this, the being tough and being hard is very real. And so and we need that more than ever today. And that is, you know, and you also made a very good point. It is, that is a distinction that, you know, women of color from communities having the extended family there, you know, not even just Power Moms, but the extended family is inherently there with among, you know, communities of color, particularly women of color. That extended family is something that is just part of the culture.
And in Inhi's case, I'd love to share one more story if we have time. Is that all right, Pam?
Yeah, go ahead before we go to commercial break.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. She was racked by guilt over the fact to be successful as an executive, she had to travel 60% of the time. Yes. But as her sons got a little bit older and they got to be school age and would have school vacations, she invited one or both parents to bring her sons along on some of her business trips, particularly when they were going to locations where there were fun things to see and do, i.e. Disney World.
That's right.
So then she could have extra time with her sons, but also extra times with her aging parents. And so that actually worked well for her too.
Yeah, and that's actually my story. For my first decade, I actually, it wasn't my parents, so I didn't have that luxury, but my nanny traveled with me, and my kids did Disney World, and the Disney World was a client. They did it so often that they got to a point where we don't want to go ride the rides anymore. We're gonna hang out at the resort this trip. And I'm like, okay, I think we've been here too much. But I did that. I traveled. I took them with me until their lives took over. But yeah, that's a real thing. And thank you for sharing that, because that is something in another way. So we're gonna stop for a moment, take a commercial break. Please stay tuned with us. We'll be right back. What great stories and tools we're getting here. So we'll be right back with you.
Breakthroughs aren't just for medical journals. They're to help people hold their grandbabies for the first time. Expertise isn't just for awards or recognition. It can be what gives people the best chance to walk again. At the Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin Health Network, people are the driving force behind everything we do. So we never lose sight of what's important. And we never forget who it's for. Because in the end, we're people helping people. That means every breakthrough, every clinical study, every interaction is to help people like you, your family, and your neighbors be the best they can be. We do everything possible because we see everything possible in you. To find out how compassion motivates world-class care, visit Frederick.com.
Don't let the tight labor market get in the way of your company's success. Open your mind to new ideas and open your enterprise to new workforce solutions. With Bold Business, companies can leverage extensive global assets and a lengthy track record of success in reducing labor costs. Don't let borders get in the way of giving your company the best possible workforce. For remote positions, Bold Business can save clients up to 30 to 50% with skilled and experienced candidates from a global talent pool. Head to boldbusiness.com for more information.
I hope those of you that have been staying listening with us are enjoying this conversation I'm having with our journalist, author, Joanne Lublin. But also, those that are just now joining us, please stay tuned so you can learn more about, you know, not just the struggles of power moms, but I want to say some of the truths and engaging opportunities that you have to learn more. So, but Joanne, but before we go on, just for your recent book first, but even for your other books, I'm sure you have a website where people can go to. And I know there's Amazon, but a place that they wanted to go to learn more about your work.
Sure. My website is Joanne Lublin, JoanneLublin.com. And at the very top of the website are easy links to several online retailers. Let's not just patronize Amazon. And you can just click on any one of those and order yourself a copy of Power Moms. If you buy a hardback version and email me a mailing address, I will send you a sticker that has your name and it is autographed by me. You peel off the back, put it inside your book, and then when you sell the book on eBay, you get more money because it's autographed by the author.
Okay, see, I didn't know that. Okay, I'm now going to have to really put my sticker on.
That's right.
Thank
that's
you.
That's why you need to put your sticker in the book.
That's right. And thank you, too.
I don't think I've mailed you a sticker yet.
No, you did. You did. I have
oh,
my
I
stickers.
Did. Oh, good. You
I
got
did.
It. I didn't know if
I
you
have my, okay. Yep, I got my stickers. Oh. And not only that, too, I also really like the way you said, hey, outside of Amazon, here's these other retailers, and I am looking, and I do like how clean your site is and how easy that is to navigate. I'm going to have to encourage folks to make sure they put other retailers out there so that way, you know, the options are beyond. So I just want to step back just one moment, though, Joanne. You talked about, you know, being a power mom yourself, of course, you know, working for the top papers and being the first bureau chief and just your own story. But you did, and this is kind of hitting with me, when you were talking like what it's like to be pregnant woman in the newsroom. And the reason this is close to me, because I just read some and talked about some legislation, as you know, some of the legislation that came out where pregnant women, you know, you're still fighting for rights of pregnant women in the workplace. You know, there is the maternity and maternity leave, but also just, you know, while you're still pregnant in the workplace, there's still certain, you know, essential accommodations and respect in an environment you're a right to have, and to have to have legislation come out to protect a pregnant woman's right is still amazing to me. But you talk about in this high-paced environment that you were actually pregnant in the newsroom. You want to share a little bit about not just that experience, but maybe some of the similarities, you know, that you wrote about in your book of having to kind of overcome some of those types of environments.
Sure. And just to, again, correct something you just said, I was not the first female bureau chief. I actually never did become a bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal. I was part of a two-woman-led bureau where the bureau chief was the woman who became the first bureau chief.
Got
it. Woman at the Journal, and I was her deputy. So when I moved over to London, we were the first bureau where the top two leaders were women, the bureau chief and the second in command. But
thank
in my
you.
Case, in my case, when I became pregnant the first time, I'm the mom of two, the irony was that a whole bunch of reporters at the Journal announced their pregnancy within a two-week period, and the managing editor went nuts and said, "This is not in my job description. I don't think they could remember at any time any female reporter announcing her pregnancy, much less in this case about a half a dozen of them." And yet only one other woman came back after giving birth, and she was in the New York bureau. I did not know her very well. I felt very isolated, very alone in the Washington bureau where I worked. There were a couple other women, but they did not have kids. There was another woman who was pregnant at the same time as me, but she quit. She was one of those that did not come back. And the worst day of my life as a new mother was waiting for the bus to go home with a male Journal colleague who turned to me and said, "So, where do you park your kid all day?" And I was devastated by his comment, to the point that when I picked up my three-month-old son, I put him in the Snuggly and spent the entire evening, till it was time to put him down for the night, carrying him around in the Snuggly, because I felt so racked by guilt.
Yeah.
Yet when I report power moms, I was struck by the fact that even some, and a surprising number of the younger wave women who are in their anywhere from, like I said, early 30s to early 40s, are met with the same sort of skeptical reaction. I remember one woman who was working for a very large PR firm. When she returns from maternity leave the first time, is asked by her colleagues, "So, how do you do it all?" And her reaction was, I don't. I depend on a huge support network, not only my husband, my mother-in-law, my full-time nanny, and a network of friends. And the assumption that I somehow have to do it all or could do it all is really outmoded. And yet it continues to be true today. We're seeing this happen now with the EEOC having just released its final rules on enforcement of the pregnancy accommodation law and saying that an abortion is one of the benefits that is covered by that new act, getting a huge amount of pushback. But this whole concept of even allowing women to have lactation space in the workplace was totally unheard of, not only at the time when I was giving birth, but again, when a number of these younger women are coming back in the workplace as new moms, they're finding themselves in dark closets or the company lunchroom, which they're trying to lock the door, but everyone is trying to break in and get their lunch bag out of the refrigerator where she's trying to store her milk. That was still not a common practice for them when they were giving birth, in most cases, you know, less than 10 years, in many cases, less than 5 years before I was interviewing them. So we have come a long way in terms of making life workable for working parents, men and women alike. And we have a long way to go, was essentially my conclusion in reporting that book.
You know, and thank you so much for your work. Also, thank you for, you know, further clarity on the for our audience on the pregnant women and accommodations in the workplace. How I think other political, you said abortion, but I was going to say other political issues, which is real, are being considered to be barriers for others. But I will say to you, you're right. Today, folks are still asking very powerful women, how do you do it all? One CEO, I happened to be in a fireside chat with a small group of leaders at the time, said the same thing. The one executive you said, you know, she says, I don't do it all. I do one thing at a time. She says, you can't do it all anyway. You do one thing at a time. So, and have that community with you. But one of the other things before we wrap up, Joanne, this is just incredible work that you've done, and there's so much more to be done. And even though we have made, you know, significant milestones and progress, there's still probably one or two major barriers and challenges that women have to overcome. You know, what in your opinion, do you see kind of reoccurring that we still haven't yet been able to quite get there in terms of providing everything these upcoming next generational women have to still deal with?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is the, and particular for women who either already have children or are hoping to have children, is the lack of control over schedules. There was a recent McKinsey study in which 94% of the women they surveyed said just requesting flexibility would negatively impact their promotion chances. We're also now in a post-COVID environment in which many women and men, for child-rearing purposes, are choosing to continue to work fully remotely, and yet you do so at your own career risk. There's something called proximity bias, which is the idea that the person I can see is the one I'm going to give the choice assignment to or consider for promotion or put on that internal task force because they're right there next to me in the office.
Yep.
By the same token, if you are working remotely and everyone else is at the meeting in person, you risk being ignored because you're the only one attending virtually. I know this from firsthand experience because the Wall Street Journal allowed me to work remotely on Fridays for many years while I was in our New York bureau. And occasionally there would be team meetings, there would be conference calls, but I was the only one who was attending by that little box in the middle of the table. And I would literally have to shout to say, hello, can I put in my two cents? But there are ways that you can deal with some of these issues. And I think the most important thing is, in particular, if you are working full-time or overwhelmingly remotely, is to make sure that you get noticed. Whether that means having an in-person ally to speak on your behalf at a meeting you're attending virtually, or setting up coffees either in person or virtually with colleagues who are going to be there in person to make sure that they can support the issues that you're going to be talking about, or making sure that you're connecting with your boss with very frequent and very thorough updates. These are all ways to not only advance your career, but to make sure you're not a victim of proximity bias.
Yeah, yeah, that's, you know, thank you so much for sharing that because, and you know, and when you talk about, you know, proximity bias too, that's something that people have dealt with forever. But, you know, when you talk about your HQ-centric environments, just like what you said, and being remote in the field just because you're in the field location. So that's very real. Thank you for sharing the continued barriers. Hopefully we know some industries are still gonna drive presence as a requirement, and where others, you know, there are others that have moved along. But I want to say thank you so much, Joanne. I look forward to really doing a deeper dive on it. But this has been wonderful. And I will say this to our audience. You know, definitely go to joannelublin.com, JoannLublin.com for more resources. Because as we continue to change, the stories and the realities that are shared in her books and her work are still going to be lessons that are going to help others. So with that, Joanne, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to continuing to collaborate with you.
And thank you so much, Pam, for having me on the show.
Appreciate you.
At UPMC, we believe care goes beyond our walls and into our communities. That's why we support organizations and individuals who help people prosper by giving them skills and training for employment, including right here at UPMC. Because life-changing is providing people a chance to grow. Learn more at upmc.com/community impact. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
From an industry-leading journal and web publication highlighting professionals and best practices, to boot camps and conferences featuring noted and accomplished speakers, Diversity MBA is a driving force in diversity, equity, and inclusion education. But Diversity MBA's education push extends beyond the public realm and into the private sector. Thanks to DMBA, enterprises embarking on their DEI journey have access to training webinars, leadership indexes, and more, all of which can help educate and transform a workforce. Embrace DEI. Diversity MBA can help. Visit www.diversitymbamagazine.com for more information.